here at Wayne State's Medical School. And I was out here in San Francisco looking for internships, and I mentioned that I had an opening at Hartford Hospital, but of course, Hartford Hospital didn't have any black interns or residents, but that was about par for the course in the de-affirmative action part of this country, which we had for 400 years. Anyway, I was staying with Booker over on Lincoln Avenue near Golden Gate Park, and I called my mother home, said I had email. I had this from Highland Hospital. I had from a telegram saying that one of the interns had gotten sick into the Barry Orville, where I had ulcerative colitis, had the surgery. They had an opening. I went across and interviewed with Mandel. I liked the Highland Hospital. He liked me, and he gave me an internship on the spot. In fact, my first rotation, I went home and packed my clothes. My uncle and I, my uncle got a used suitcase, not used, this leather trunk. So, and took all my stuff in and shipped all my books and boxes. I remember when my Uncle Bill, my father and I, went to the train station, Michigan Central train station. This is huge, majestic, towering building with high ceilings that we used to go to and pick up my grandparents and various relatives to visit, and the place would be a mob of people. It was like a ghost town. We went down there and there's nobody there. And we finally went around beating on doors and found someone who could ship the trunk out, but it's incredible from going there in the 50s and seeing mobs of people to going there in 1968. It was like a ghost town. It was a shell of his former self. I thought before I would get involved with internship and residency and work with the Panther Party, we'd go back, because we were talking about Black Bottom and some of the people that my family and I knew. My parents were always helping people out. We had little, but whatever we had, we were sharing. We're always willing to share with people who had less. Like across the street in apartment 10 was Mrs. Henry. She was a blind lady.
Across the street or across
the hallway in apartment 10 was Mrs. Henry. She was completely blind, and she must have been close to 80 then. And she was kind of like my parents. They, you know, helped her with her shopping and everything, and we kind of looked after her. In fact, she died after we had left Black Bottom. I remember going to her the undertaker to see her. And we had some characters in that apartment building. It would make Peyton Place look like a, needless to say, look like Little Orphan Annie. Ed Montgomery and Johnny Pearl lived downstairs. Ed Montgomery was supposed to be the super. He's supposed to be managing the place, but he never did anything. He had two daughters, Betty and Juliet. And he had this old drunk Arthur, was his brother-in-law. Arthur used to be sitting around telling us tall tales.
You want to talk about Reginald Henry and Barry?
Arthur. Yeah, Arthur would brag to us how he used to pick 100 pounds of cotton, and they used to put bricks, rocks, and everything in the cotton. I think they were from Georgia originally. Most of the people from Alabama and Georgia, most of the Mississippi people went to Chicago. But Johnny Pearl was always having her boyfriends while her husband was at work. Arthur got pissed off at her one day and grabbed. We had made some stilts that we used to walk around on. Arthur grabbed my brother's stilt and was chasing Johnny Pearl down the hallway door with the stilt. Johnny slammed the door shut, and he ran in and broke my brother's stilt. Arthur was a character. And we used that the barefoot prophet, this guy used to come on with a little rag around his head, barefoot. He used to claim he used to be barefoot in the middle of the winter. Then he would have these little looked like pumpkin heads that he claimed were skeleton heads. He would go into Sam's Cutlery, buy some salt, break a circle around it, keep the devils away, and he would be out there just preaching away. We always look forward to the entertaining aspects of the barefoot prophet, who would, and there would be just mobs of people sitting around watching him as he preached. Mrs. Henry had two sons, Forrest, who had about 14 kids, and Reginald, who was always getting in and out of trouble. Reginald would taught my brother and I how to play checkers. And Reginald's had this crazy girlfriend by the name of Mary. I remember Mary got hot after someone across the street came home wanting to take my mother's butcher knife because she wanted to do some carving on some woman across the street she was upset about. We talked earlier about Mr. Henry, the coal man, ice man. We used to buy our ice and coal from him. He lived in a kind of a Victorian wooden structure across the street from us. And Mrs. Henry was completely psychotic. And I remember once this guy came walking down the street with a big, wide Mexican sombrero on, some colorful outfits, and apparently it was like waving a red flag in front of a bull. Mrs. Henry came out of her house cussing and swearing, and she followed that guy up the street cussing and swearing, and I didn't know Mr. Henry could curse like that. Apparently something about the way he was dressing infuriated her. Ask me a question again.
Wanted to go back and talk about these people for a specific reason, and I was wondering why these people carried such significance for you in terms of your memory.
Well, you know, Black Bottom had a lot of madness and craziness, and these people typified some of the madness and craziness. Black Bottom also had a lot of love in it, and my parents looking after and taking care of Mrs. Henry was part of the love in the extended family we had in Black Bottom. At the time when we wanted to put a central veins catheter, which is a catheter going to the central vein, we had to do cutdowns to do it. And as an intern, our job was to do the cutdowns. I learned how to run a code there. And the thing I remembered, even though Highland was a county hospital, we were in the old building of Highland, a beautiful Julian Morgan building. At least it was clean. It was unlike Detroit receiving, where you would go down the basement to eat and you'd lean up against the wall and your shirt would be dirty. And the records were very well kept. In Detroit, you compare it to Detroit General. Highland actually had made the news, because I remember reading about it about a year or so early in the papers in Detroit. It was the first public hospital history of this country where their employees were going to put on strike. Of course, that's not true now, but at that time, it was the first public hospital where the employees had gone on strike. It was Highland Hospital. I had been involved with the STIC project, and a friend of mine, Bob Mance, was actually one who ran the Black Panther project in Lowndes County. They took the nickname Black Panther because it was Courtland Cox's nickname. They needed a nickname to nickname to combat the white rooster. Stokely Carmichael actually got a lot of credit for that, but it was actually Bob who did all the organization work behind that. Anyway,
that's a little far.
We talked about George Green. Well, we had two crazy Georges in Detroit. One of them was George Green, and the other one was George Sams. And I used to call him Crazy George number one and Crazy George number two. George Sams turned out to be the agent who testified against Bobby Seale in New Haven. But George Sams was Stokely's bodyguard. And in fact, George used to do some crazy things. George would go to a party with Stokely and push Stokely in the closet and lock him up in the closet and told him he had to, for security reasons. George was nuts. Anyway, I went happened to go over to the Fermi Park. The Panthers were having a rally, and there was all these Panthers walking around with their little uniforms and everything. And I said, George, how come you're not walking around marching with everyone? George told me there was all a bunch of bullshit. The Bobby was out there getting all these people marching around so the FBI could know who they were. He wasn't going to be marching around with those damn fools. Anyway, George called me up one night. And, he said Stokely was staying over at DC's house in San Francisco, which was on Steiner Street. He wanted to see me, so I went over there. Actually, I went over there with a couple of classmates from St. Mary's who were out there visiting at the time. I remember talking to Stokely about Crazy George number one, George Green, who we had dumped on his house in New York. And I had a little tongue-in-cheek. I said, well, you know, George is a good man. Stokely looked at me and smiled and said, yeah, but he takes a lot of patience. After I'd finished my internship, which is a rotating internship, I was waiting for my license to come in the mail. At the time, I had no plans to go into internal medicine. I was thinking about going into neurology. I'd accept a neurology residency at the VA. And I had applied to UC, which actually I might have taken the residency, but at my medical school, they wrote me such bad letters that the guy who interviewed me was the chairman of Tarpon, said, we'd love to give you a position here, but, you know, our work here is very difficult, and it's really hard, and you have to be very intelligent, and this and that, and that he didn't think I was qualified to do the work. And so they didn't let me in the program over at UC, and so I didn't have a license, so I decided, well, I'll do a year of internal medicine, which is why I did a year of medicine. I had no thoughts of becoming internal medicine doctor. In fact, the thing I really enjoyed was emergency room medicine. In fact, I was the first medical resident in the history of Highland Hospital to rotate as a staff doctor through the emergency room, because prior to that, they would only let the surgeons run the emergency room. The emergency rooms were usually run by the first year resident, surgical resident. The two staff doctors, one was Byers, who was a surgeon, and the other one was Blosser. And when I was at Highland, I was one of the best house staff doctors they had. I worked very hard and took very good care of my patients. And back during my internship, I lived above the emergency room, and I remember when Elvis Cleaver got involved with that, got poor Bobby Hutton killed. that Warren Wells got shot, I think, in the leg or butt, and the emergency room had a holding department at that time where people, they weren't sick enough to be admitted. They would keep them in a holding area overnight for 24 hours, and I heard it on the radio. I said, oh, well. So I went down and actually talked to Warren Wells to talk to him while he was down there. After I did my first year of residency, I had actually, Mark Comfort, who was a very good friend of mine, who had a group called the Oakland Direct Action Group, and Mark was a good friend of Bob Mans. He had done volunteer work in Lowndes County. And Mark and I, after my internship, Mark and I actually went to Mexico. We drove down to Baja together, which was kind of a crazy trip. I had went back and gotten my little red Plymouth Barracuda that I had borrowed the money from buying medical school. I actually had planned to buy a car out here, but I went down to Volvo, and they told me I hadn't been working long enough, and they didn't want to give me credit, and they didn't want to sell me a car, because I was going to give that car to my father. I had bought a used car, and the transmission broke down in it. So I said, well, I'll go back to Detroit and get my car. And I went back there, and actually there were a couple of dudes from the Detroit SNCC office who were coming out here to work with the Panther Party. One of them's name was, I can't remember their names. They both, I saw their pictures in that book, The Vanguard by the Panthers. So they actually drove out here with me. And it was so funny as we were going through the fruit inspection for the fruit, their pistols fell out. They thought they were being inspected for guns, but it was so funny. It was a fruit inspector that the pistols fell out. But anyway, no one saw it. But I dropped them off at the Panther headquarters. At the time, a lot of my people I'd worked with was SNCC and Luke Tripp briefly. Got involved with the Panther Party because what happened, there was so much rage in the black community. And when the Panthers put up in Sacramento, they became a national symbol for this rage. Malcolm X had been killed. Shortly after that, in April of that year, I think they had killed Martin Luther King, so the Panthers became a northern symbol for the resistance. Anyway, I told Mark I was thinking about going to work for the Panther Party. Mark had went to Sacramento with him and actually had lent Bobby seven of his weapons, and he was pissed off because of Bobby never got his weapons back because he thought the police had committed a crime. I'm sure if Bobby had paid for the weapons, he probably would have gotten them back, but since he didn't, he got them for free, he wasn't concerned enough about getting them back. And Mark couldn't get it back because all the people who got arrested with the weapons got them back. Mark told me that at that particular time, when he got up in front of the courthouse, he said Ronald Reagan was sitting in front of the state capitol with a bunch of children. He said he pulled off his M1 rifle and pointed at Ronald Reagan, and said Ronald Reagan bit his finger and took off running and left all the kids there. He said he went in for the John to take a leak. When he got out, he said all the Panthers were all standing around with their hands up, and the police had their weapons drawn on them. He was behind the police, so he had to drop on the police. And so he started to get the police to drop their guns, but Bobby saw him, and Bobby started screaming, Mark, put your gun down! Mark, put your gun down! Anyway, after I'd done my second year residency, my first year residency in internal medicine, 1970, and I didn't really want to be an intern, so I had taken a job at the West Oakland Health Center. It was a community clinic in West Oakland. I actually went by the Panther headquarters, and told June Hilliard if they ever needed a doctor, give me a call. I kind of was aware of what I was getting into because Mark had told me that there was a problem with incompetency and corruption in the leadership. He said he got along better with the San Francisco Panthers. get their newspapers to sell them, that they were thoroughly infiltrated by police agents. He said he had a trade to work the federal building and see every 2 weeks on 1970. He said every 2 weeks he would see the people coming by with the black leather jackets to get their paycheck. In fact, the police agent, I think their second issue, published an article that was saying ODOT was a bunch of police agents. They had to go down there and threaten to take care of David Hilliard and his group of feet into a formal apology, which of course the Panthers did. In fact, I think that's the only group I ever heard the Panthers formally apologize for, and all the groups they were bad mouthing.
And then they put him on a pig list.
But anyway, so I went by and told June Hilliard that if they ever needed a doctor, give me a call. I felt that since I was in Oakland and they were at the cutting edge of the movement, that I probably should get involved with them, although I realized that they had some problems with leadership and infiltration of agencies, from at least my conversations with Mark Comfort. But to show you how infiltrated they were with... I hadn't even met you.
Anyway,
sorry for the interruption, folks. Back to the date. Anyway, to show you how infiltrated they were, the FBI actually called up Dr. Nelson the next day to tell him one of the doctors decided to work with the Panthers. Unfortunately, he called up David Nelson, who was an intern in Highland, who later told me the story many years later. Instead of Malcolm Madison, who was actually the medical chief of the hospital, period.
Malcolm Nelson,
yeah. When I started working with the Black Panther Party, I started teaching a health class at the... The year is 1970. I finished my first year residency. And as I mentioned earlier, I had went by their office on Grand and talked to June Hilliard and mentioned that they needed a doctor to call me. During my internship, I had worked at a free clinic in San Francisco called the Blackman's Free Clinic, where I met Dick Fine, who actually had been doing some work with the Black Panther Party, period. I started off actually teaching a first aid class, preventative medicine, community health class at the in West Oakland, at the West Oakland Center of the Black Panther Party. Their headquarters was actually right down the street on the, eventually moved right down the street on a Victorian house on Peralta Street. Essentially, I was the physician for all the Black Panther parties in the Bay Area. And Black Panther Party had 44 chapters. And operated 9 free clinics. And I guess it had become kind of an embarrassment since places like Seattle and Chicago, Philadelphia had free clinics, as well as Los Angeles, and the national office hadn't opened up a free clinic. So John Turner, who was the leader of the Berkeley Black Panther Bunch, and Claudia Grayson opened up the free clinic at 3236 Adlan Street in South Berkeley. And eventually I was there 3 days a week. I was there Monday afternoon, Wednesday evenings, and Friday mornings, period. At that time, the Vietnam War was raging, and I was reviewing my correspondence, and I saw multiple letters that I had written to people to help them avoid the draft. My work with the party involved going in and out of
many prisons. I was the first physician to go in the adjustment center at San Quentin. And Folsom. Also at the time when after Angela Davis visited, I wound up becoming her physician and visiting her twice a week at Marin County. And then when she was shipped to San Mateo County Prison, I visited her once a week, period. Huey and Angela had asked me to go visit George. George was legendary. George Jackson was a legendary figure in the prison system who was attempting to organize the convicts, black, white, and Mexican, against the racism and classism in our society, and prevent them from being utilized by guards, fighting among themselves, period. George was on trial as being one of the Soledad brothers. Apparently, three of their friends were actually murdered by guards. The guards would set up prisoners. They turned three black folks, and they would put them in a room with put them in a yard with the Aryan black brothers in the stage of that, where they know there would be a fight. Then they would proceed to stop to break up the fight, and they would murder these three black prisoners. And a guard was thrown down off the gangplank. The walking plank was killed, and George Jackson, Fleeter, Drum Gun, Shepard were charged with his murder. I remember the first day I went into San Quentin prison. The guard at the gate searched my little black bag, and then I was led through the prison grounds and walking to a very cold, off-red-colored building, the Adjustment Center. There I saw a very tall, handsome man caged to the wall. They had these little casket-like cages. He gave me the power to the people salute. When I walked in the room, Rochelle McGee was sitting down, and he didn't care that much for attorneys. He asked me where I was attorney, and I told him no. For those of you who don't know, Rochelle McGee was one of the prisoners broken out of prison by Jonathan Jackson. Was the only one who actually survived, and he was kind of like a jailhouse attorney. They took me in the room to examine George. They took me in the regular office room, and I had to use the desk for the exam table. And the guards, the room was surrounded by guards while I examined him. And I gave George a couple of history and physical. George was concerned because he had ingrown toenails and wondered, oh, could I do something immediately to fix him? And I arranged for George Roden, who was an Olympic gold medalist at 400 meters, to go visit George. And the court order said that either I or any doctor I select would have a right to visit George. And George Roden went out to visit George. They refused to let him visit. Then they sent George out to the prison hospital when he had his... And George said he realized that it wasn't a doctor I requested. He said when the patient asked him, feeling any pain in his toe, and he said yes. And when he said yes, the doctor proceeded to cut on his ingrown toenail. And then they made him walk back over 100 yards to his cell immediately after the surgery. And George told me he realized at that time that it was not the person I I arranged to see him. I actually only visited George three times because of the fact that Ward Nelson had the court reverse the court order saying that I was a security risk, period. I remember going into the, June Hilliard asked me at one time to go visit Randy Williams. Randy had apparently ambushed a policeman on 14th Avenue. And understand he had hand grenades and automatic weapons or submachine guns and had injured a policeman, I guess, for the rest of his life. And I remember going in there and doing a complete history and physical on Randy and coming back and giving the history and physical to June. And June had a very puzzled look on his face as, what was this? But I took care of all the Panther kids. Did a lot of pediatrics. All the adults. Did a lot of colds. Once at the George Jackson Free Clinic, we had a gonorrhea epidemic that was going through the party. I actually trained some of the co-workers to do pelvics and move the cervix, see where they have pain, and do the GC cultures and screening, because it was involving a large number of people. It was around this time that I met my wife. What happened was I had Mark Comfort had introduced me to most of the members of this group, the Oakland Direct Action Committee.
Oh, Dak.
And the day after George Jackson was, I guess the following court day, Monday after they had assassinated George, is on maybe no one really knows. What I was told happened was that George, when he ran out for the prison, he said it was the time of the dragon, and he got shot in his heel as he was diving for the bushes. And I heard after they had secured the place and found that the three guards were dead, that a guard came up to George, and George told him to suck his dick. And a guard on the tower decided to execute George at that particular time and shot him in the neck while he was laying on the ground. That's the real story I was told, but I don't know if you know, if anyone knows the exact story how George was killed. George was a brilliant person, a very poetic writer who believed in socialism, and he believed in revolution, and he erroneously thought that the Black Panther Party was a truly a revolutionary party, period. It's actually how I wound up meeting my wife. My wife, the day after the Monday after the murder of George, during the court, the survivors, Jack Luchette, Flea Drumgoole, were in the court, and apparently they had been tortured, and Flea had cigarette burns on his back from the guards, and I understand that the judge was saying he had not been tortured, and Flea took his shirt off, and I think Jack Luchette's mother gasped at the torture. At this time, Tax Squad, which had been waiting to vamp, came actually into the courtroom and attacked the citizens. And they actually, as I understand it, had pictures of John Turner, who, and Philip Price, my brother-in-law, was involved with all that brother, so people they wanted to beat. And my wife had stepped out of the courtroom, and she heard they're being filled, and she came back in, and she said there were four people. There was a police on each extremity of his, and they were busy clubbing him. All you could see was blood coming up. And they had Marty, handcuffed Marty. And they later told Marty, put a machine gun to Marty's head and told him that they'd killed his brother and they were going to kill him. And so George, my wife, ran in and attacked one of the police officers. And a friend pulled him off while the police was clubbing him. That's how she got away. Staley, my brother-in-law, was actually the only one who got away. I think he made Time magazine slugging a police officer. He actually, in order to help his brothers. But and so they took Phil to Mission Emergency Room in San Francisco, and Joe Myers, who was the orthopedic doctor resident there, called me up and said that there's this lady who told her to call me. She looks kind of like Angela Davis, referring to my wife, but my wife didn't look anything like Angela Davis. And he told me they had beaten the shit out of Phil, but they were going to keep him there because they were afraid if they turned him back to the police station would beat him some more, which is probably the case. So that night, around about 2 o'clock in the morning, Marty came over. He wanted me to come by and visit his, examine his brother. So I went over there and I examined Marty, And Marty said, "Oh, by the way, why don't you look at my sister?" So he woke his sister up, and I examined her and asked her, "Did she need some of the sleep?" She said, "Ah, she had been sleeping." She was a little irritated about being awakened, but I actually called her up, and we started dating after that. My wife's views of the Panthers were completely different than I, and I was thought they were a revolutionary organization. They were involving and setting up. I thought they were a revolutionary organization. They had free food programs. They were operating a free clinic. They set up the first national sickle cell anemia program, which I actually set up for them. They were trying to set up a free shoe program. They had a busing program for busing women to prison. They basically essentially had so-called survival programs, which they were setting up to, in order for the people to survive until they could have a revolutionary just government, which provide the needs of the people instead of the needs of the corporations, period. And Huey was a legendary figure at the time who came out of prison, and of course, I was very active in the party, although I was not a member of the party. I was their physician for 4 years in the period. But my wife was rather cynical about the party. She had good friends in high school who had joined the party and who were beaten in the party and later accused of pigs. My wife had a couple of classmates, one, Mati Laba, who played the violin with her, who was apparently beaten badly by Bunchy Carter, who was later murdered by us. And she had another friend, his name, I believe, was Greg, who was beaten up. Her brothers had to actually hide by the party. The party was so infiltrated and policed by police agents that one of their police agents in their first newspaper published an article said that the Oakland Direct Action Committee were all police agents. And of course, the ODAC people got their guns and went down there.
So the old divide and conquer.
Man. Yeah, and told David Hilliard if they didn't apologize, they were gonna kill him and everybody else in the party. So David apologized, and actually I heard him on the radio apologizing. But that's how the police were so infiltrated. As Mark Comfort told me, he said every 2 weeks you see all the black folks in the black leather jackets showing up to pick up their checks. But my wife felt that there was a thuggish element in the organization, and she was never very supportive of my work with the party. Period. To give you an example, Jimmy Carr, who was Huey Newton's bodyguard while he was in prison, Jimmy was a very close comrade of George Jackson, and Jimmy was a very large, muscular person who one day told my wife that he was going to visit the Supreme Servant of the People. And my wife said, "You mean the supreme pimp?" Jimmy got very angry, probably would have slugged my wife. Jimmy was actually used by Huey. Huey was very critical of Fred Bennett. I think Fred Bennett had a master's degree from the...
You're naming all these people not giving any kind of background of who they are.
I said who Jimmy Carr was. He was ex-prisoner. He was a classmate of George. He was Huey Newton's background bodyguard. He was a very close friend of George Jackson. What more background do you want me to give? The fact that he grew up in Los Angeles. And Fred Bennett was a guy. I was giving the background. I said he had a master's degree from Stanford. He was married. I think he had about 5 to 7 children. He was very active in the East Oakland branch of the party. I remember meeting him when he came down to the West Oakland House. So apparently he had been criticizing Huey's line. So Huey told Fred that he was a police agent and committed him to executing. At that time, the fate of anyone who was thought to be an agent was death. There was basically a war going on between the black revolutionists and the forces of the power structure. So, ironically, Jimmy drove Fred into the Santa Cruz Mountains, the FBI was completely aware of this because the two people riding on one, Tom Mosher, and the other one, the other black person was riding with him, were both FBI agents. And so when Fred told them there was a police agent with us, they both started shaking and reaching for their weapons. When Jimmy told them there was a police agent with him, they both started shaking and reaching for their weapons, thinking that one of them was the police agent. However, it was Fred, and Jimmy took Fred into the woods and killed him. And then he actually burned the body. Just left bones. And ironically, he told my wife, who used to go up to Santa Cruz Mountains, not to go up there anymore because there had been a murder there. And so Jimmy, who went to prison because of when Jimmy went to prison, apparently, this was before George was murdered. George had gotten a fight with a bailiff in the court, and Jimmy went over to help out George. Jimmy was actually a brilliant person. He was teaching math at the University of Santa Cruz. And when his parole was revoked, Jimmy found out that the Panthers basically ignored him and didn't give him any support when he was in prison. So he later sent word to my wife that she was right when she said he was a supreme pimp. When Jimmy got out of prison, he went up to Huey and slapped him and called him up and told him he was going to kill him. Told him he was a punk and he was going to kill him. So Huey, when I was in China, Huey hired two assassins from Los Angeles who actually executed Jimmy as shot him as he was leaving his house and killed him. They were later caught. That night, Huey was calling Sacramento trying to get an attorney to defend him. But, you have to try to give a balanced view.
I think a better example would have probably been...
What would be a better example?
It would probably be how they kept Enola and interrogated her, because I don't know if you really want to publish this kind of stuff in the oral paper. Do you want to talk about?
No, I don't know. I don't know. But anyway,
Do you want to talk about that kind of stuff? Because this is oral, and my teacher is going to read it.
Well, maybe not. But I think there were murders in the party, and I think these things I'm saying, I don't think there are anything that's not new. The FBI knows all about it. Their agents were with Jimmy when it happened. They didn't care. They didn't care about black folks killing black folks. They perpetuated that. They they created myths that weren't there. To give you an example, when Huey had kicked the New York 21 out of the party, the New York...
It's still going.
I know. It kicked the New York 21 out of the party. They were 21 members of the Panther Party who were infiltrated by police agents and who were trying to get them to commit crimes and later testified that they were planning to commit crimes. The police agents did. It was actually the very police agent who was the police agent who was Malcolm X's bodyguard. It was the same police agent who had infiltrated the Panther Party. They were so infiltrated that Attorney Booth told me one of their chapters, I think it was either in the Bronx or in Brooklyn, were actually founded by three policemen. They were all licensed members of various police forces. And anyway, what happened was the New York 21 told the Panther Party that they weren't the vanguard. The Weatherman was the vanguard. There was some criticism of Huey's line. Huey wanted to go into survival programs to organize the people. Well, there was another factor in the line, which was Aldous Cleaver's line, that they felt they should be practicing guerrilla warfare and should be assassinating policemen. Anyway, so Huey not only kicked the New York 21 out, but he confiscated all the money that had been arranged for the defense committee. He had Marty Kennedy, I believe it was his name, turn all the money over to him. And so when Huey was flying to New Haven to meet with a professor there, Michael Tabor and Daruba, who were two members of the party, New York 21, who were out on bail. They couldn't get everybody out on bail, so they thought they would get their leaders out. They were planning to fly to New Haven to talk to Huey about letting the New York 21 back in. Well, the FBI sent a letter to Melvin Newton saying that they were flying to New Haven to kill it. So the FBI was COINTELPRO, was at work getting people to kill each other. They had already, I would not be been surprised if they played a part in Bunchy Carter and John Huggins' murder, because they were members of US, United Slave Organization, which was founded by Ron Karinga. At one time I had driven to Fremont to take care of a brown beret who had, in a demonstration, had gotten a superficial gunshot wound in his foot. And he had asked me to take care of him. I drove out to take care of him. And he asked me, as we were talking to him, he asked me, do you know about Ron Karinga? And I said, no. Well, you see, he said, Ron Karinga had gone to the head of the brown berets. Brown berets were also infiltrated by police agents. And Ron Karinga had gone to the head of the Brown Berets and said that he had gotten a lot of money from the federal government, and that if the head of the Brown Berets wanted to cooperate with the federal government, they could get a lot of money too. Ron Karinga later went to prison for torturing a woman and putting a poker, hot poker, up her vagina. This is the founder of Quanta, so maybe this means good can come from evil, I don't know. But the very fact that he was an agent of the FBI and that his man killed John Huggins and Bunchy Carter, I'm sure they were involved, you know. And, Huey, Huey actually and Aldous had a falling out, on the radio program, where they both wound up going off on each other and threatening each other. And after that, He told me Aldrich, even when he was in a party, was always running around raping people in his little van. But it turns out that whenever Huey would leave the Oakland, the FBI would send letters to Aldrich saying Huey was bad-mouthing, and of course, Aldrich couldn't call Huey up because Huey would be out of Oakland. So they played a major role in infiltrating the party. The J. Edgar Hoover felt the Black Panther Party was the main menace to his society. And so we can, I think I've always felt that the problems with the Panther Party rest in FBI infiltration and two, in lack of integrity and leadership. I felt the troops were very idealistic. Many of them were brilliant. And in fact, a lot of the troops, people who were in the Panther Party, have gone on to get PhDs and law degrees and medical degrees. Like Henry Smith, who used to do our hemoglobin electrophoresis at the George Jackson Free Clinic. I'm told he's a physician now. And I felt that there were a lot of very talented, hardworking people who were trying to serve the people and provide and to create a revolutionary society of wealth, which would be one based on social justice and not exploitation of the have-nots by the haves, period. Anyway, we're talking.
For people, what were other positive things about the party?
Yeah, we did provide.
Impact your life.
We did provide free medical clinic at the George Jackson Free Clinic. And it was hard work. Anything in medicine was hard work. Sometimes I would be working at that clinic to 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. I remember one evening I saw 22 people. And all the people who worked at the clinic were volunteers. The place was kept clean and mopped. We had all of our medications were given to us. And there were dedicated people, for instance, Ron Satchel, who ran the clinic in Chicago, had came out and worked. He and I wrote the key article launching their sickle cell anemia program in the Panther newspaper and set up the National Sickle Cell Anemia Program. At that time, the country was spending only about $50,000 on sickle cell anemia, and I think it was about $3.7 or $3.9 million on multiple dystrophy and $1.78 million on cystic fibrosis. And sickle cell anemia had a greater morbidity than any of these. And we kind of dramatized the neglect of sickle cell anemia. And I think, you know, one of the things when I look back on it is that we put pressure on Richard Nixon so that he put $6 million to the sickle cell anemia. Now we have sickle cell anemia foundations throughout the country. We forced the federal government to realize that there are poor kids not getting breakfast in the program, and they set up a breakfast program, period. And I think we even made Martin Luther King popular because all these people realized that you got all these crazy black folks carrying guns versus Martin Luther King having nonviolence. It certainly made Martin Luther King's message a lot more, not more acceptable. But Ron Satchel and I actually traveled to one 3-4 day weekend. We went to Portland, Seattle, and Los Angeles, where I was spoke, gave press conferences, talked about sickle cell anemia, how it was being neglected, and why the Panther Party used the term black genocide. In fact, we set up a sickle cell anemia foundation. Linus Pauling was on this foundation. Ossie Davis's brother was on the foundation. He was in Portland. Period.
As a medical doctor, to actually serve, like, people for free, people don't do that kind of stuff. Most people don't go into that. I mean, why did you choose to work for the Black Panther Party?
For the Black Panther Party because I was a freedom fighter. I was fighting racism. I was fighting injustice. I felt that there could be a better lifestyle. I felt that the government, the people who pay taxes, the government should provide for the health care needs, should provide for the education. I thought that we should organize people to make changes in the government in one way. And I had worked for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and when I was in medical school, and in the medical school, I'd worked for NAACP when I was in college, and I worked with the Black Panther Party. And I believe that the society needed to be radically changed. I felt that, you know, there were poor people going hungry, and there were people who didn't have health care, and the police in the black communities' basic job were not so much to protect as to brutalize. I remember my brother and I and Paul Clark were walking down the street one day, and they stopped Paul and asked Paul, "Ain't your mama black?" At that time, that was an insult. "Ain't your mama?" And Paul actually slugged the officer and took a gun away from him. But the police officers were basically killing people. There was one, and there was one school ground, Hutchinson School, where like 5 kids were killed from running across the playground. The police just shot them. There was a prostitute, Cynthia Scott, on John R., that cursed out the policeman, turned her back to walk away. Police pulled out his gun, shot her in the back, and killed her, and then took a knife out of his pocket and threw it at the ground by her. And there were multiple witnesses who saw it. The judge threw all the witnesses out, said they were unreliable characters. I remember as a medical student going and picketing 1300 Bowman at the Detroit police station because of the murder of Cynthia Scott. Milton Henry was a friend of Malcolm X's, and Wilford X, who was Malcolm's older brother, spoke at the rally. And after the rally, I got through picking the police station. I went back to my medical school, which was about 4 blocks up, and I looked in the police officer's garage, and there were just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of white police officers, because all the police were white in those days anyway. And I guess they had planned to be there to, in case there were any problems, to come out there and basically beat everybody up, period. But I got involved with the Panther Party because I believed in justice. I believed in fighting against racism. I believed in creating a better society. And that's why I got involved with Panther. I realized that they had some problems, but I felt they were following the right line, and from the point of view of trying to provide health care, trying to provide clothes for people, and I felt that, and plus I felt that the American community, the American young people in our society were in a rage against racism. They were in a rage against the brutality that you would see on television set, and you would see in Bull Connors turning dogs on young kids who would be biting them, people being hosed down and beating. We had over a century of lynchings in our country. In fact, the white folks would say that if we don't feel good, we'll go kill a nigger. It'll just make us feel better. He said the tortures of the lynchings, where crowds would gather around and they would cut someone's finger off, cut their ears off, pour gasoline on them, burn them alive, and then raffle out the parts of the body. And the ministers wouldn't condemn lynching because they didn't want to offend their parishioners. That's a whole culture of lynching in the South. So black. When I was in Mississippi in 1955, as a 13-year-old, I was there 4 or 5 months taking care of my grandmother, whose picture sits on that wall. They killed a 13-year-old kid, Emmett Till, for allegedly whistling at a white woman, beat him badly, and tossed him in the ocean. Period. And so there was a rage in the black community among young people. And I think the Panthers symbolized this rage when they went to Sacramento. And I felt that that it was correct to fight against oppression, and that I felt it was correct to fight against oppression. And so I supported any progressive group who would fight against racism and oppression and the haves versus the have-nots. That's why I got involved with the Panther Party. What other questions do you have? That kind of sums up why I got involved. And because basically, I looked at myself as a freedom fighter. If I was in South Africa, I probably would have been, I remember talking to Gene Burger once, who was the head of Wayne State SNCC, and we were saying, we're fighting against racism here. I said, if I was in Soviet Union, I probably would have been, would be fighting against totalitarianism. You fight against injustices. Times when black folks couldn't vote in the South, it wasn't the 50s, they could teach in the northern schools, they were discriminated against in the white colleges.
What were the main things that you got out of working with the Black Panther Party, like your trip to China, starting the sickle cell, specifically those type things? Do you feel like talking about that?
Well, one thing is working with the party, it taught me that you could organize and you could, like a single spark could start a prairie fire. You could start with one or two people and you could just organize it. You go into people, you listen to people, you listen for what their needs are. I think we talked about the sickle cell anemia program. We basically tested. We had the 9 free clinics across the country. We tested 3 people with sickle cell anemia. If the traits became positive, if they had sickle cell traits, we counseled them the fact that if they got married, that 25% of their offspring, of their kids, could have sickle cell anemia. And it was a very neglected disease, and black folks didn't even know it existed. At the end, 10% of people in the country had the trait, and maybe about 0.09% actually had the disease.